Conference record has joined the conference.
Hey, Dennis, we got that recording rolling if you're ready.
I'm here.
Awesome. All right. This is Dylan Mielberg of Grateful Web. I am honored to have with me author, historian, and veteran publicist Dennis McNally. McNally's 1978 biography of Jack Kerouac and the Beat Generation, Desolate Angel, caught the attention of Jerry Garcia, who brought Dennis into the Grateful Dead organization. He was more than their publicist and biographer, but a valued insider who formed intimate friendships with the band and particularly Garcia. In his biography of the Dead, A Long Strange Trip, published in 2002, it is undoubtedly the most comprehensive piece of literature on one of rock's most beloved groups. His first book in 12 years that comes out tomorrow from Counterpoint Press is On Highway 61, Music, Race, and the Evolution of Cultural Freedom. It's great to have you with us, Dennis.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. On Highway 61 brings needed context to the contributions of African-American music and its connection to the roots of American culture as a whole. It's a culmination of so many singular seeming aspects of our history that are truly interrelated. How many years of research did it take to compile this book?
I put in about 11 or 12 years. I'm slow. What can I say? This book was a little different also because compared to the first two books, at least, both the first two, you know, had a ready-made plot and, you know, clear divisions. I mean, Kerouac was born and died, so, you know, for starters, that's the obvious. This one was like completely, at least started as a completely open-ended thing. I asked the question, and I really didn't know the answer. And it took a long time. I don't know, I was reading for 2 or 3 years before I decided that I had a vague idea of the answer and the shape, which, as you say, turned out to be, I mean, the question was, why did the 60s happen? Well, you know, what was the source of all that? And there was some immediate stuff that was obvious, like LSD or the birth control pill or the war in Vietnam. But, you know, what went further back? And eventually I decided that it was this ongoing relationship between what started out as just a very few white people and over the course of the late 19th and in particular 20th century, became, you know, quite a large number of white people paying attention to black culture, paying attention on the political side simply to the fact that, you know, if they're not free, if black people aren't free, starting with Thoreau, who of course was actually dealing with slavery, but throughout, if black people aren't free, then white people aren't free either. You know, we're in this together. It's a requirement. As I say, so that's why it took so long, at least in part, is that, and I'm slow, is that it took me a long time to know what I was researching. I mean, I was just poking my nose into all kinds of questions. And for starters, even in as late as my first draft, there's like 150 pages on Thoreau, mostly because I got interested. You know, I have joked that this book was a chance to go back to graduate school as long as I was running the program. I was perfectly happy to go back to graduate school. And so I read up on, you know, deeply on Thoreau and ended up sensibly being asked by my editor to cut it, and I ended up being able to cut it to like 5 pages because, as I say, it took a while for me to understand what the actual subject was and what the answer to my question was, insofar as, you know, you can answer a very complex question with a simple answer.
Well, sure, and it boils down to cultural freedom. And what differentiates cultural freedom from freedom in general?
Well, in America, at least since the era of Alexander Hamilton, which is to say pretty much since the start of the 19th century, freedom, and certainly actively today, a large proportion of Americans think that freedom is really the freedom to make as much money as possible. economic freedom. That's really the most important freedom. And in fact, they'll tolerate limits on every other kind of freedom and shrug, and you know, just does not bother them. But as you know, as long as you know they can make lots of money, we have a political, you know, the reality of the current political struggles in this country are you've got this extreme right wing, the so-called Tea Party, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a front for the richest, you know, the 1% in America, the truly wealthy, and making sure that they can continue that the tax structure go back to, you know, well, we don't really want to tax them very much because of the so-called trickle-down theory. We don't want to limit their options in terms of making money, like with the EPA. So there's all that stuff. But the point, the truest point of it all is that the issues that the Tea Party runs on are social issues. And they're social issues that all of which stem from the 60s. In fact, the right wing in America, at least since Ronald Reagan, has been running on an anti-60s platform, which is kind of makes this book, or this is sort of why I wanted to write this book, is because though it ends in 1965 and it looks back, it's extremely contemporary. I mean, it really is the roots of exactly what's going on now.
Yeah, absolutely. It all trickles down, like you said. All content there and aside, just one of the most rewarding qualities of reading your work that I've noticed is that you write about history as a novelist might. You color the past for your contemporary readers in a way that other historians struggle with. How does eliminating sort of a drama of the factual past aid you as a writer?
Well, you know, one of the things Buddhists say is that, you know, that there really isn't a past or a future. There's just now. But the point is that, you know, now has all this inherent drama. It's our lives. One of the nicest compliments I ever got was when I turned in my doctoral dissertation, she actually had been a housemate at one point, but a friend of mine, who was a filmmaker, said that, wow, you know, you write very cinematically. And I hadn't thought of it in that literal sense, but then I went, well, yeah. I mean, the point is, it's telling a story. And you tell a story with detail, with information, with sense data, with, you know, was the sun shining and did it, you know, what did it smell like? And, I mean, you don't always have this information, and you writing history is not the same as writing a novel where you have... I just was reading, I'm going to interrupt myself because I do that a lot. I just read yesterday in a detective story, a guy turning to another and quoting Raymond Chandler, who's the famous detective story writer, who said, when you don't know, you know, when you're at a point in your book where, you know, you don't quite know where to go, what to do next, have a man with a gun come to the door. And I thought that was a great line. It is a great line. And obviously in fiction, you know, boom, you can make it up and have a guy with a gun come to the door. Obviously, in history, you are constrained by the facts. But that doesn't mean that you can't write in a way that appeals to people's senses, such that they understand that this is a story. It's an incomplete story because, you know, you just can't cover everything in history. It's a story. And one of the little fights that I pick in my book, actually, is with a certain – it's contemporary academic style of writing history in which largely – there's this theoretical matrix. It's all this is analysis that's sort of applied on top of the story, so that the story is told through the matrix. And even though I happen to agree with a lot of it's very political and a lot of it's very left wing, which happens to be my politics, but I have a real problem with applying a theoretical matrix to the story rather than simply ideally letting the story tell itself. I would say that most academic critics, if they read my book, they will call me old-fashioned because I lack this theoretical matrix. As I say, I can live with that. I mean, I think they're wrong. It's all well and good to as an example, it leads. I cite in my book a very, very good book, by the way, by the book as a whole, called When We Were Good, which is a study of folk music in America. But he goes into this criticism, I guess is the only way you could describe it, this description of the Fisk Jubilee Singers as being sort of entrapped by middle-class morality in a stereotype of dutiful suffering. And there's a grain of truth to what he says. I mean, he's, you know, but the fact is that what you're doing is analyzing behavior in the 1870s by the standards of 2014. That, you know, somehow implicitly saying, oh, they should have been revolutionary. He's sort of saying they should be revolutionary. Well, that's not realistic, and it's not historical for starters. It implies values that values, you know, don't evolve over time. Look at gay marriage. You know, you could sort of say from that every closeted gay person in the 1920s was somehow deficient because they were in the closet. Well, that's not realistic. I mean, you know, it was the 1920s. So anyway, that's at least one of the things that's going on in the book is hopefully an attempt to just tell the story in and of its time.
Illustrating then, absolutely.
Yeah.
An interesting, out of all the intersections and moments in history throughout the 19th century that build your book toward the 20th century, when things started to get completely fascinating for me was when you brought in musicologist and folklorist John Lomax. He's generally cited as an invaluable archivist of the folk canon, and your book has a balanced look at certain controversies with dealings with musicians and perhaps even the accuracy of his archiving. Do you think that Lomax's legacy is in need of reexamination?
Yes. it's being reevaluated, and some of it's being reevaluated by the that sort of leftish point of view. And certainly Lomax was not a lefty; he was very conservative. It is, and it's stuff that troubles me. I mean, you know, there was a book about the Georgia prison system, which is, you know, horrific. It's medieval. I mean, even in the 1930s, it would be very difficult to say the chain gangs and all that are, you know, well, this is all okay. There was an expose of it, this is at the time when Lomax was visiting prisons and looking for songs. It got in his way because obviously after this expose, people were like, you know, in this prison system were going, oh, do we want to let people have access? And he criticized that. And, you know, it's sort of self-serving in that sense. But here's a better example. His first book was about cowboy songs. And one of them that he identified as a folk song was Home on the Range. Well, eventually he was sued by the guy who held the copyright. It wasn't a folk song. It was some dentist, I think it was a dentist or a doctor. Some guy in Kansas had sat down and wrote Home on the Range, you know, which is not the folk process. And, you know, okay, I'm not criticizing Lomax for not knowing that. You know, it's embarrassing, but, you know, there you go. There's stuff that you don't know about. But having experienced that, he should be extremely careful in the future about identifying songs as folk. For instance, Goodnight Irene. So he ended up working and in some ways exploiting Huddy Ledbetter, otherwise known as Leadbelly. Mm-hmm. And he identifies Goodnight Irene as a folk song, when in fact it was a minstrel song. He, you know, Leadbelly may have learned it from his uncle, as he says, but his uncle got it, you know, from the song bank of, you know, songs floating around in the world. It wasn't a folk song. And that, you know, you say, well, having experienced that, you ought to be really meticulous about how you identify where songs come from. So, yeah, Lomax can stand a little revision. He did some great work, and it's important stuff. But he also, you know, he led on that Leadbelly got out of prison because of what he, John Lomax, did, and that's not true. So, you know, that takes a little polishing around the edges.
Yeah, I found it fascinating and didn't really know all about. I knew much more about Alan's legacy, but not so much about John. So the orchestral jazz of the 1920s became the choice dance music for white youths of the time. In certain ways, it represents the first overcoming of the racial segregation barrier in American culture. Do you think that generation understood their significance in embracing black music?
Well, keeping in – no, the answer is no. And the reason of that – a tiny fraction of them did. I mean, for instance, the group that I identify as the Austin High Gang, which is a bunch of young guys, and actually their greater circle, which was a bunch of young white musicians who grew up in the 20s in Chicago, and which was the great black city of America at the time, and had, you know, at every, I mean, musicians that we think of as legends, starting with King Oliver and Louis Armstrong, Bessie Smith, in clubs, you know, on a nightly basis. And they listened to this music, and they said, this is great music, and the fact that it was black was not a handicap to them. It was, they recognized that the black people were the source of this jazz. They loved this music. They wanted to play it themselves, and they did. And they ended up being dominating the industry by the 1930s, at which point it's called swing music. But you have to understand that most of the big swing bands were all white. People, the majority, Jack Kerouac is an example. The majority of white youth listened to white bands, and maybe vaguely knew that jazz started with black people, but you know, it wasn't, unless they were serious fans and started, you know, researching and reading up, or, well, there weren't a lot of books to read, but just collecting old music, they probably didn't know that so much. And you can see in Kerouac's biography what happened was, you know, in high school in Lowell, Massachusetts, you know, he's a swing fan, and then, you know, I don't know how much he knew. He didn't, you know, write up on that. But we do know that in 1939, he graduated from high school. He goes to a year of prep school in New York at Horace Mann Prep School to play football. He's going to play football at Columbia, and did. But they put him in at Horace Mann for a year to get, you know, gain weight, all that sort of, you know, athletic stuff. And he ran into a guy there who started taking – Horace Mann is 50 blocks north of Columbia in the Bronx. And his friends started taking him around Harlem and experiencing black life, including black music. Other things too, but in particular. So he sees Count Basie, the Count Basie Orchestra, for the first time, and suddenly he realizes, oh, that's interesting. This music, which is, you know, considerably improvisational, what they call riffs, you know, this is better than a lot of these white bands that are like kind of static and there's not a lot of looseness to it. That happened a lot, and by the 50s, you know, that lesson was completely clear. As jazz was integrated but dominated in terms of popularity by black musicians because they happened to be the best. That, which is not to say that there weren't plenty of white musicians around. But in the 30s in particular, in swing, it was a slow transition, let's just put it that way. It took some education and some learning. And it really took until the 40s or 50s for a majority of the white youth that were listening to jazz to realize its origins and come fully appreciate it. But even before that, they just knew that it was the music they loved. I mean, what in the 1920s was seen as subversive and morally dubious and so forth and so on, by the 1930s, it's the national music. Whoever's playing it, it's the national music is jazz.
Absolutely. So many historians who have focused on the development of blues music prefer to mythicize the ambiguities involving Robert Johnson. Mm-hmm. Your account brings balance to the legend. What does Johnson's legacy in music represent to you?
Well, what it represents to me is that there are four or five of some of the finest songs ever written. I mean, I think that Come On In My Kitchen and Hellhound On My Trail Love in Vain and a couple others are, you know, simply, you know, masterpiece songs. As I say in the book, you know, what ultimately there's been a whenever you get a completely extreme response to something, a positive response, as the crit, you have to, let me go back. So in 1961, King of the Delta Blues is released. It's the first compendium album of about half of Robert Johnson's songs. You know, he put out a few in the 30s. They went nowhere. One of them was a very minor, Terrapin Blues was a minor hit. But in general, his two recording sessions and 29 songs recorded didn't go very far with the black audience, and this has caused some recent revisionist historians to say, well, you know, he's not part of the great black tradition, and you know, really, and it's he's not very important, and he's only important and well known now, and has all this attention because a bunch of white people fell in love with him in the 60s, which is true. I mean, every British guitar god for starters, Bob Dylan for starters, a whole lot of other people heard him for the first time then and went, wow, this is a distinctive voice, which I think is sensible. This is also true of a lot of critics at that time in the early 60s, guys like Real Marcus. And the problem is they were so enthusiastic that it's just they're an easy target to you know, sort of make your critical chops by slamming them. I think you know, looking at both sides, as I say, it's not just I might add, it's not just these guys. I once had a wonderful conversation with Chris Strakowitz, who is the leading light of R. Hooley Records and one of the important musicologists of the last 50 years, field recording, the blues, black music, all kinds of different music. He's the man who really brought Cajun music to a wider audience in America. He and I were talking, and at some point, I said something about Robert Johnson, and he did the, oh, you guys with your Robert Johnson, he just wasn't that great, and you know, blah, blah, blah. And I looked at him, and I said, now, wait a minute. You're telling me that you'd rather listen to Leroy Carr who did How Long, How Long, and you know, he was a very popular guy, a very successful record seller in the 30s. You'd rather listen to Leroy Carr than Robert Johnson? And he went, yes. I went, well, you know, taste is everything. All I can say is, not me. I mean, I like Leroy Carr, but if I had to listen to one or the other, it would be Johnson. There's a whole lot of fog around Robert Johnson because of the mysteries, and this whole thing about, oh, you know, did he sell his soul to the devil for, you know, which was a passing remark by somebody, which got simply beaten out of any perspective over the years, because people just found this, you know, there's a reason that the Faust myth, the whole principle, which goes way back before Robert Johnson, of course, that the Faust myth exists, and there's a reason it continues to exist, and that is it has some intrinsic appeal to people, that you know, this idea that people would be willing to sell their souls for, you know, immortality you know, complete knowledge like the original Faust, or the ability to play great music. They said the same thing about Paganini, I might add, the great 19th century, maybe 17th, 18th century violinist, that he, you know, he had sold his soul. Well, you know, this is all good, well and good, you know, in terms of myth, but the fact is that with Robert Johnson, it was made as a joke. You know, he comes, he goes away. He's a mediocre guitarist at best. He goes away, and he comes back a couple of years later, and he has exploded. He's just fantastic. And people make this silly remark. Whereas, in fact, well, gee, you think maybe he just worked his butt off for a year? And, you know, just really got into it and serious about it? You know, so you don't have to. There's no need for supernatural explanations, and getting involved, you know, and making a big deal out of these implications is not good thinking, or, you know, not sensible thinking, I think. You know, in African folklore, for instance, a crossroads has mythic, you know, spiritual and mythic significance. It's where magic happens. And it's true that Johnson wrote a song called Crossroads. But if you read the lyrics to this, among other things, if you read the lyrics to the song, he's talking about literally being afraid at the crossroads because he's hitchhiking. A black man hitchhiking in Mississippi. At the start, he's vulnerable, at least in his era. You know, it wasn't supernatural. He was worried about some cracker coming along and killing him. And he says, he calls out to God, you know, spare poor Bob if you please. You know, this, you don't have to, I mean, you don't have to read any supernatural stuff into it. So.
Excellent. Thank you. So your book is structured into three parts: Race and Freedom Principle in 19th Century America, African American Music and the White Response, and the third surrounding the origins of Bob Dylan. What makes Bob Dylan the arrival point of a book focused on African American cultural freedom and history?
Well, Bob, most people think of Bob Dylan as an heir of Woody Guthrie, you know, and folk music. And the fact is that if you study his sources and his origins, a significant part of his entire work is that he is the summing up of a perfect fusion of black and white sources, both. Namely, rock and roll, which, you know, bringing it all back home, he goes back to, it was his high school music, when he was imitating Little Richard. And I just that plus he's profoundly connected with the civil rights movement of the 1960s, which is, you know, the political side of the freedom principle. So as far as I'm concerned, it sums everything up. And then on top of all that, it's a fact, it's just a historical fact, that when in that section too, when I talk about the, you know, the origins of relatively recent black music, which is to say the blues, ragtime and jazz, and how they originated in the late 19th century, they all came into existence within 50 or 100 miles of the Mississippi River. And one of the big moments for me when I started this research was looking at Dylan and realizing, well, yeah, he's on the river too. It's a long way away, and it's at the other end.
Yep.
But he's connected. And then what you find out when you study him is one of the really important things that happened in his life musically in high school was he started listening to a radio show from Little Rock, Arkansas. Back in the day, you could get radio stations after dark, you know, from way, way far away. And there he is up, you know, almost to the Canadian border, and he's listening. And it's a show, it's called No Name Jive, and the DJ was a guy named Frank Gatemouth Page, a white guy, but who's playing Muddy Waters and Jimmy Reed and Little Richard and Chuck Berry and the very best, you know, this is 1957, the very best contemporary, top 40, as it were, black music, you know. And it happened at Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and all that. This is not the normal experience of a kid in Hibbing, Minnesota. You know, they kind of lean more towards polka. So I just think he's sort of the heir, H-E-I-R, the heir to all to this whole story. And so I've had at least one reviewer say, there's too much Dylan. It's like, well, I take your point, but like I say, I think he is the perfect way to recognize the, you know, the path of this story. And I might add that, of course, he is also the one who wrote Highway 61 Revisited.
Yeah.
So it kind of connects everything up for me.
Absolutely. And it seems so ironic to me that Dylan was chastised in the pinnacle of his career from the folk community as a traitor for producing rock music when his earliest music connectivity was with rock. In reality, the cry that the Dylan in the early 60s was most immediately protest music. So what was Dylan's protest music so close? Why was his protest music so closely identified with folk? Was it any less powerful in the rock idiom?
It was a lot more subtle in the rock idiom because by the time when he went into the rock idiom, he was writing more personal songs, which were just as much about freedom as the so-called protest songs, but they were personal. Something like Chimes of Freedom or Desolation Row or Gates of Eden. All that is absolutely, the central issue with each one of those songs is personal freedom, but it's not as easy to as obvious or easy to digest as "Blowing in the Wind," which everyone, you know, went, "Oh, this is an anthem." The fact is that folk music and protest had been interconnected at least as far back as Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger in the 1940s, and Lead Belly, I might add. All three of them played together, at times lived together, and explicitly wanted folk music to have a populist political bent. And Dylan, you know, lived through that. Remember, at Newport, you know, it's 1965, so it's 1 year after the Beatles. And I suspect that for many, you know, the thought that was going through the mind of a lot of critics who were like dumping on Dylan for having picked up an electric instrument was that it was, you know, simply a commercial sellout. You know, this is the new thing, this is the new fad, and he'll he's you know going to drop our virtuous and pure protest you know oriented folk music and go be a rock star. The fact is that he made that move, I would argue, out of artistic need. And if it's one of the interesting things is if you listen to Bring It All Back Home, you've got, you know, it starts acoustic and ends up electric because, but he was trying songs in both modes. He'd do it solo acoustic. He did Love Minus Zero, No Limit as an acoustic, a solo acoustic thing. And then eventually did another version where, you know, other instruments came in and because it made more sense. He didn't, you know, he was experimenting constantly as a musician. So, you know, I think he made those decisions for aesthetic reasons, not any other. And a comfort thing. I mean, because as you said, he started out as a rocker. And it was like, oh, gee, now I can go back. I mean, you know, it's what I always loved. It was very easy to see why you would turn to folk in the early 60s because, frankly, rock was boring and dead. You know, most of the stars of the 50s, you know, Little Richard had retired to the church I've just gone blank on the name. But,
Chuck Berry with.
Oh, well, I was thinking of the white piano player.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Jerry Lee Lewis had gotten, you know, into a huge scandal because he'd married his cousin, and a 14-year-old cousin, or distant cousin, I think, but whatever, you know, the age is what disturbed people, et cetera. And Elvis goes into the army, and Chuck Berry gets arrested, and blah, blah, blah. So it had lost its oomph, and the same with Garcia. Jerry had also been in a rock band in 1957, playing electric guitar. But, you know, in 1961, he gets intrigued with acoustic music and then shortly thereafter with banjo and, you know, passes through the same pattern as Dylan.
There you go. Dylan is rightly chronicled as a sarcastically reflexive narcissist after fame wore on him. With Dylan's hostile attitude about being considered a cultural revolutionary, a form of self-mythicizing?
Well, I don't know if it's self-mythicizing. The fact is you get stereotyped. And hardly anybody likes to be stereotyped. They all think, you know, I'm a musician. I think different things and I'm, you know, blah, blah, blah. Whereas getting labeled, you know, protest singer, and it was a labeling that went both ways. It was a labeling not only by the media, which at the time didn't, you know, frankly didn't take any young musician seriously in the first place. I mean, it's like, you know, today, how likely is it that somebody a mainstream journalist could take Miley Cyrus seriously?
Yeah.
And treat her seriously. Treat her without, you know, without being loaded with stereotypes and whatever. Deservedly or not, the fact is that people go in and they're loaded with preconceptions about, you know, if you go in to interview Miley Cyrus, you assume that. And it was true back in the 60s when this is the first completely youth-oriented music thing. From the Beatles on, you have this incredible wave of popular music, and it's all young, and it's all appealing to the young. And then you have these middle-aged journalists who find most of it, you know, silly or trivial or whatever. The Beatles were able to deal with that because, for starters, there were four of them. They could make jokes to each other in a way that's kind of healthy and comforting. I watched that with The Grateful Dead, where, you know, they would get, you get media that would, like, be really dodos, but at least they you know, there was a great scene in the 20th anniversary of Grateful Dead press conference in 1985, which we did only because I got so many calls. You know, the band was like, okay, it's an anniversary, that's nice. It's not like they were all that wild about it, but I got so many calls from the media. I said, look, guys, please, would you save me from having to arrange 20 interviews? Could we do a press conference? They said, sure, okay, we'll do a press conference. So they do a press conference, and this TV guy starts asking a question about drugs. And it's like, you know, they don't need to talk about drugs anymore. You know, it's been 20 years. It's like, enough already.
Yep.
And so they respond by kind of basically saying, he's talking, but I can't hear what he's saying, right, to each other. And the guy is so clueless, he starts talking louder, as though they can't hear him. And eventually they just basically, you know, laughed the question away. And the Beatles were great at that, you know. They were just very funny, and they would disarm the press. Dylan did not have that gift. A, he was alone, pretty much. I mean, there was nobody else in the room with him. He had done this incredible feat of grafting significant intellectual content into pop songs, which is new, you know, astonishing and new to begin with. And he was, you know, he was angry about many. I mean, as a protest singer, he wasn't singing out of some vision of you know, a golden future. He was singing that he was furious with the present, with how America, which had the potential to be a great, you know, read God on our side. I mean, it's a complete history of America, and how what had been supposed to be about freedom, spiritual freedom, in fact turned out to be a lot of stereotypes and a lot of dead Indians, among other things, and a whole lot, you know, and a lot of war, just wars in general. Bad, you know, really bad wars that just you couldn't justify. And he was angry. And I, of course, when you have when you're having an argument with someone, if you're really furious, you almost always lose, right? Because you can't think straight in the middle of all that. And he it wasn't like he was furious in that sense, because his press conferences were witty, but where they fell down is that they're so he's just exhibiting such contempt for everybody but himself that you can't better to listen to the record. Let's just put it that way. But I strongly recommend that anybody to watch Don't Look Back, because you've got this incredible contrast between this amazing music he's making. But this is a guy who's, like, living on the edge of creativity. His brain is on fire. It's been like that for 3 or 4 years. And he's taking himself, he's got very limited human relationships at that point that keep his head on straight. You know, that's one of the great things about being in a band, is nobody will let you, you know, you can't get away with stuff with them. They know you. Garcia couldn't turn into an, you know, egomaniac, because Lesh would, you know, the rest of the band just wouldn't let him. I mean, they'd give him so much grief, he'd have to laugh. Dylan didn't have anybody like that. And he got caught up in it all. And fortunately for him, and part of it was just physical exhaustion and doing a lot of speed to you know, just to keep up with the schedule he was on. And, you know, what he ended up doing was the sane and smart thing is, when he had his motorcycle accident a year after my book ends, from all accounts, it appears it was a fairly minor accident, you know. Might have cracked a vertebrae, but we're not talking about a broken neck or anything life-threatening. But he used it as an excuse to stop, to get off the train, to get off the treadmill. He had come back from the world tour of 1966 to be told that he had 50 more gigs to do. and his agent, you know, his agent was acting like every other agent, which is, if you can make money now, let's make as much money as you can now. And Dylan said, stop.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't tour again for 8 years. And it was a very, I don't think, if he had tried to continue, he would have died. Something would have killed him. There's just a limit to how much a human being can put out. I mean, if you think about the sheer quantity of music that this man made between 63 and 66, 62 and 66, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
So
you talked about when the book concludes, when you end on Highway 61 very consciously. You don't go into Dylan's motorcycle accident or his foray into country-inspired music. You don't go into the evolution of the British invasion or the transformation from hard bop to jazz fusion. Why end the book when you did?
Well, for starters, you know, at 430 pages, it's not like it's short. It seemed, you know, appropriate in terms of Dylan. I do touch a little bit on the British invasion because, of course, it had a considerable impact on him. It freed him to play rock and roll again, for starters. So I touch on it. The book, you're talking about developments in jazz. The fact is that the book's not a history of black music. It's a history of white reaction to black music. Now, I have to talk about black music in order to talk about the white reaction. But, you know, I never talk about Ray Charles, for instance, who's so important. I mean, there's just so much that you have to leave out. And so the answer is I ended it where I ended it because that felt right.
Yeah.
It was poetically appropriate that this song, which is an homage to what connected black and white people, him as a white kid listening, and black musicians playing on the radio. That's full circle, and once you reach full circle, it's about time to stop.
Perfect. Good enough for me. Dennis, that's great, and I pretty much. You say it in your conclusion, and that's just more for our readers. That you answered all my questions, Dennis. Reading your book hugely broadened my understanding of the development of American culture as a whole. I urge music buffs and history buffs to read this vital account of U.S. history. It'll change the way you think of both music and freedom. On Highway 61, it's already being regarded as an important addition to the canon of American music literature. Thanks for your research in compiling this fine chronology, probably the finest since Grail Marcus's Mystery Train, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, thank you. That's rather impressive company to be even mentioned in. So and as a matter of fact, I bought a copy of Mystery Train pretty much when it came out, and it's been floating around my library for 40 years or so. I truly appreciate it.
Absolutely.
It's a great, you know, I mean, it's the story of America, which makes it, you know, a very interesting story. So I had fun.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you're latest in 12 years. All our listeners and readers are going to have some connectivity to it, and I encourage everyone to go out and buy it on its release date tomorrow. Dennis, we'll be in touch. I think we got a great interview, some great material to put out on the book.
Good. Well, if you have any, you know, side questions or clarifications, feel free to ask. And otherwise, thanks and have a real good day.
Yeah, you too, Dennis. Much appreciated. And I will be in touch if there's anything. We got we got about an hour conversation to work with. So try to get that up timely for the release date and everything.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you feel free to trim.
Awesome. We'll do. And I've done a bunch of this, so it'll flow well as a transcription, and I'll get that to you as soon as it's ready.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, I just want to know the link so I can tell folks about it. Thank you.
Excellent, Dennis. Yeah. Well, pleasure talking with you, and
it's
we'll catch
a pleasure.
Up.
All right. I'll catch up with you soon. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.